Carl, you wanted in on something? Oh. Pardon me?
After. After the one. Thank you.
Okay. We're on paper six, right? Okay.
Okay, so agenda paper six concerns recognition of deferred taxes and when acquiring a single asset entity. The interpretations committee received a request to clarify whether an entity recognizes deferred tax when it acquires all of the shares of another entity whose sole asset is an investment property. The acquired entity recognizes a deferred tax liability for the taxable temporary difference that arises from carrying the investment property at fair value. In addition, the acquisition is not a business combination. The purchase price for the shares is less than the fair value of the investment property and is equal to the equity held by entity B, i.e. the fair value of the investment property less the carrying amount of the deferred tax liability. Our analysis is presented in paragraphs 16 to 25 of this paper. We think that the accounting requirements are clear. In an asset acquisition, paragraph 2B of IFRS 3 requires an entity to allocate the purchase price to the identifiable assets and liabilities of the purchased entity in proportion to their fair values. Further, paragraph 15B of IAS 12 presents the acquiring prevents the acquiring entity from recognising the deferred tax liability in its financial statements. We conducted outreach on this issue. The results of our outreach are summarised in paragraphs 9 to 15 of this paper. The outreach indicates that the predominant accounting treatment is consistent with our analysis and conclusions. The submitter thinks that the possibility of recognising a day two gain if the investment property is measured at fair value is inappropriate because it does not reflect the underlying economics and is not consistent with the underlying rationale of IAS 12. We considered whether the requirements in IAS 12 should be amended. Our analysis is presented in paragraphs 26 to 35 of this paper. As outlined in paragraph 32, we think that any project to amend IAS 12 would have to take into account different variations of the transaction and would have to consider other issues that arise when a single asset entity is purchased. We think that these issues would be better considered by the board. However, based on the feedback received on the agenda consultation, the board recently concluded that a review of IAS 12 was not a higher priority than other projects and decided not to add a project on IAS 12 to its work plan. The papers presented to the board in May 2016 highlighted issues with single asset entities, often referred to as copper wrappers. The relevant extracts from that paper are included in Appendix C for your reference. Having considered these factors, we recommend the Interpretations Committee does not add a project to its agenda that proposes the board amend the requirements in IAS 12. Paragraph 36 presents our assessment of the issue against the Interpretations Committee agenda criteria. On the basis of our analysis, we recommend the Interpretations Committee does not add this issue to its agenda. We have two questions on page 12 of the paper. We would like to ask the committee whether it agrees with our recommendation not to add this project to the committee's agenda, and in addition, whether the committee has any comments on our proposed wording of the tentative agenda decision in Appendix A of the paper.
Okay, I'd like to. Carl was so eager to get in on this one, rang in before we started, but then I'd like to bring Mary in because she had some suggestions on the wording of the agenda decision yesterday that we all thought were on point. Carl?
Thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation. What I'm struggling with is the fact pattern itself. I'm not sure if it is realistic. And if it is realistic, probably there is a fair value measurement issue in practice. Because in an arm's length transaction, you will never sell an asset before below its fair value, unless it's a bargain transaction or something like that. Therefore, I agree with the wording of the agenda decision, but if more people agree with me, probably the part of which describes the share is less than the fair value. This part describing the fact pattern should be maybe removed or adapted because, in my sense, it's unrealistic.
Correct me if I'm wrong, team, but there's no question about the fair value of the transaction was a cash transaction. The question was, though, that the deferred tax item is inextricably linked to the asset. So you're stuck with the position of having to record the transaction at the transaction price, and then the next day recognize a day one adjustment. So I think that was the issue that people were trying to grapple with, not that it wasn't an arm's length price.
But it's the fair value of the, it's less than the fair value of the investment property, but not less than the fair value of the entity that holds the property.
That stated better than I did.
The entity only has one asset.
Right, but in the jurisdiction in which the property is located, if the entity disposed of the property, the entity, regardless of who owns the entity, would owe tax. And so that, in effect, depresses the value of the entity below the fair value of the property.
The entity or the seller?
The entity.
Okay.
Mary, you had a suggestion, though, about the wording of the agenda decision.
It was just, as I read Appendix B, which is the submission, and looked at this, I think the submission is entirely consistent with the analysis, but maybe not as consistent with the setup of the agenda decision, or proposed agenda decision, because the proposed agenda decision presents it as if there was significant lack of clarity about what the requirements in IS 12 are. And I think both the submission and the analysis make it clear that the question is, should the requirements be amended so that there's not a possibility of what is seen as a non-economic or a non-economic reality day two gain, especially because avoiding that type of gain was one of the rationales for introducing the initial recognition exception. So that, to me, the agenda decision, rather than referring to a request to clarify and then concluding that there's enough guidance, I would imagine if the committee agreed with the staff recommendation not to take the project on, that would be more a matter of explaining that the submission asked whether the requirement should be, the initial recognition exemption should be amended, and that the, I think one of the things I saw in the staff paper is that while the submission identified concerns about the possibility of day two gains and losses, and noted that it's inconsistent with the rationale for the initial recognition exemption, I think the staff analysis is that any amendment to that is a significant undertaking that would have to be done at the board level. So it's not whether or not the requirements of the standard are clear, but whether or not the committee recommends reconsidering the initial recognition measurement, initial recognition exception. And if that's the case, I think it maybe be better for the agenda decision to track what the actual consideration was rather than characterizing it as, was it clear? Yes, it's clear. And I think this could be accomplished keeping a lot of the material that's in here that points to the relevant requirements, but just being more faithful in terms of what the issue is.
You have some language to propose? Offline.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go Andrew, Mikhail, Bob. We'll just go around the table. Andrew?
Okay, thank you. On the transaction price, I agree that in the fact pattern, it's probably not a realistic transaction price because it's not going to be just the deferred tax difference, but it's not going to be the 100. It's going to be something in between 90 and 100 because, for example, the deferred tax will not be discounted, so there could be a question of when it's going to be paid and the effect of discounting there. So in practice, when we see these transactions, it'll be somewhere in between maybe if there were anything here to put in, you would say, well, let's assume the price would be 95, which would probably be more like reality. In terms of the tentative agenda decision, I was reasonably happy with the wording. I've got a couple of suggested amendments which I can pick up with the staff offline. Just on this point of the initial recognition exemption, while it may be that there was a notion of eliminating a day two adjustment, I had also thought that one of the key parts of the rationale for the exemption was to avoid an iterative gross up for non-tax deductible assets, where something bought for 100 would end up being 141 with the 41 deferred tax liability if you had a 30% tax rate. And so it wasn't so much this day two adjustment, I think, that was in focus, but the gross up instead.
Miguel?
This is very common in Sweden, where we have this kind of transactions done. And I think as well then that, I mean, the price will be some kind of sharing of this tax benefit. So it will be another price then. But in addition, when you have it in a company, there will of course be some kind of legal company tax liability as well, which I think that we had in another topic here. So it's much more complicated. And it's probably so then that we cannot solve it, but I think that maybe as you said then that we should recognize that this is a problematic area and that there is a concern here. So not so straightforward as it's written, more like it was in 2014 July expression.
Bob?
I agree with the staff recommendation and analysis. I think the literature is clear in this. Not particularly enamored with the answer, but I don't think that there's something that this group can do. I do think it's good to raise to the board. I'm not sure it's exactly only an IS 12 issue. I think there's some unit of account issues also in here. Last comment, I do agree with Andrew. I would make a recommendation to just adjust the beginning of the proposed agenda decision. I don't think it necessarily is that the purchase price reflects the carrying value of the shares. It usually is something different, but the point is that it is something different than the fair value of the investment property.
Yeah. Okay, we can do that. Bruce?
Thanks, Wayne. I agree with where the staff's got to. I guess the only thing in the back of my mind that kind of just doesn't sit right with me is why wouldn't we just fix this? I mean, couldn't we just simply fix this by putting in part of adding in another rule? It's another exemption. I mean, that's what the initial recognition exemptions are. They're just a bunch of exceptions from the general principles. And, you know, if we think that there's a challenge, put it in.
I'm looking to Anne because she's going to give us the lecture on why.
I thought when I saw her going.
Gosh, she's not going to play poker.
She just went.
We did try to resolve this issue some years ago, and because you get different fact patterns from all the different jurisdictions that do their tax in different ways and structure their transactions in different ways, we could not find a solution without destroying IS 12 effectively. So I recommend we don't do that.
Let's not go there.
But then you have to recreate or create something instead, and you know, we did have a go, but it gets the different situations you get mean that the different rules that you'd have to put in to accommodate all the different situations just become totally unmanageable.
And that's, I mean, you know, I guess from my point of view, I'm not enamored with the answer. I think I can accept well on the agenda decision. I'm saying, and if you guys say you've been through the process of saying we've looked at it and we just can't get there right now, I'd be happy with that. And as long as I think we've given it kind of a try and said, look, we did. Because, I mean, you know, when somebody initially reads this, you think to yourself, this is just an exception. Surely I can just put in another one and we're there.
No, I think Anne's right. Every time we picked up this rock,
it just wasn't worth it.
Stuff crawled out from underneath it. And it just, we, I know we, that was back when we were doing the amendments to 12, wasn't it?
It was when we were trying to.
Trying to do the amendments to 12, and we just.
We couldn't, could not make any.
Couldn't make it work. Bertrand?
I had just a question. I understand what is written in the paper from the perspective of the buyer, but on the perspective of the seller, it's quite strange, because if the seller has sold for 90, it means that he has also transferred, probably to the buyer, its tax obligation. Otherwise, he would have sold for 100 if he had kept its tax obligations. And so there, so from then, if you revert back to the seller, why, if the seller has also bought the tax obligation from the buyer, then why not just reflect that? 100, 10. It's there. I'm quite. I totally understand from the buyer's perspective, and if you only look at it from the buyer's perspective, but then if you look at it from the seller's perspective, then there's something I quite don't understand.
The seller doesn't have the asset anymore.
Yeah, sure, but...
But so it doesn't have the deferred tax obligation that went with the asset.
It's consolidation.
Yeah, but yeah. If he has sold for 90, what is merely an asset that is worth 100, it means that he has also sold the tax obligation. Otherwise, I don't understand why he would sold for 90 something that is worth 100. So from the seller's perspective, it's quite strange.
I think it works in the seller's account.
There's probably something I missed, but
I think from the seller's accounting perspective, there shouldn't be an issue, because it will be a deconsolidation issue for him. Yeah. So he'll be taking off both the asset, the investment property, and the deferred tax liability that goes with it.
I was more reasoning economically.
Yeah. So if he sells for 90, it's because effectively he has passed the tax obligations. Otherwise, he would have sold for 100. And then if you think of it, if he has passed because maybe in some instances the tax obligation has just disappeared, but sometimes not. So if not, what has happened for the bank?
Okay. John?
I mean, I agree with the staff analysis. There is actually a way of dealing with this within the initial recognition exception, which is to draw a distinction between the initial recognition exception as it applies to unrecognized temporary differences versus the initial recognition exception as it applies to already recognized assets and liabilities, which this is already recognized. But I'm not proposing to sort of open that up. But you could actually do this as an exception to the initial recognition exception, because it's a recognized deferred tax liability in this situation. Just in relation to the agenda decision, I mean, I do think the submitter has asked two questions. They've asked to clarify that the initial recognition exception doesn't apply, which of course it does, and they've also asked to amend IAS 12. So I think the agenda decision should ensure that we address both of those, the clarity that it does apply and the fact why we're not considering or proposing and recommending an amendment.
I think that was Mary's proposal, I hope. Tony?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with where it's got to. I think it reflects the standard. I share the comments that several other folks had, that the price is unlikely to reflect the carrying amount of the deferred tax. There'll be a whole series of other things that affect the price. And it might be a picky point, but I just wonder whether we ought to be clear we're talking about the consolidated financial statements, because in the separate financial statements, it would simply be an investment in a subsidiary.
Bonnie, and then we'll go to Sandy.
So I think I have two comments. One is similar to maybe what Bertrand was saying in paragraph 27, where it talks about the issue arises because the asset bought and sold, i.e. the shares of the company, the legal entity, is not the asset that the purchaser recognizes in its financial statements, the investment property, which I understand that point. I think it's illustrated in the example that Bertrand gave of the seller's accounting versus the purchaser's accounting, in that the books of the world don't balance because there's kind of this missing deferred tax liability until day two when it's a P&L, which seems a little bit odd to me. And I think where I had a little bit of heartburn, and I'm not trying to open Pandora's box here, but I understand the substance of the transaction, and that's how the staff have analyzed it, and I do agree that accounting should reflect the substance of the transaction. However, if I think back to some of the discussions that we had around IFRS 10 and 11, the legal entity in some cases seemed to take precedent over the substance of the transaction by the mere presence of a legal entity. And so it just seems like there's a little bit of a disconnect. Sometimes you look through the legal entity and sometimes you don't. And I think that's, I'm not necessarily suggesting the staff analysis is wrong. It's just there are some differences in how we discuss the legal entity and the substance over the form, which I know we had a lot of discussion about substance over form there. So I agree with the staff analysis. I don't necessarily like the answer. And I think I had a similar comment to others that the agenda decision, I don't think fully reflects that, and I think it should.
Yeah. Okay. Sandy?
I agree with the staff analysis. I don't have anything to add other than what others have said.
Okay. Thank you. All right, then.
Wayne, can I come in?
Oh, yes. I didn't know you were back. Don, please, do.
Yes, I'm back. I recovered a little bit during the last hour. We discussed this issue as well. We believe the answer is in accordance with paragraph 15B of IS 12. However, we question, like most of the members, whether the answer is sensible. For that reason, we would like to support those who would say, okay, transfer this issue to the board and ask them to address the issue in the medium term, even if IS 12 was not a priority in the letter to the agenda consultation. I support also the comment that sometimes we look through the legal entity from a substance perspective, and sometimes we do not. When we look to the proposed wording, we were wondering about the second paragraph, which starts with the application of paragraph 15 of IS 12 and ends with the application of paragraph 2B of IFRS 3. We would have expected that the second paragraph would start with the application of paragraph 2B of IFRS 3, and then the issuer will discover that they cannot recognize the deferred tax liability because of the initial because of the initial recognition of the exemption in IS 12 paragraph 15B. And finally, we were wondering why in the heading of the decision it's only said that there is a single asset entity. Normally a single asset entity will not contain a business, but maybe it would be more clear if that would be added to the heading and to say that the entity does not constitute a business. Finally, we agree that the fact pattern presented is not that realistic in terms of the fair value, because the deferred tax liability in the entity is not discounted, and in the purchase price for the shares, the deferred tax liability will be discounted. Thank you.
And that you anticipated something I was going to add on to this, going back to Andrew's comment. Even if the discounting of the expected payment of the deferred tax obligation was the only thing that made it different, you'd have a day two adjustment.
Yep.
So it's unavoidable in a sense. Okay, I think we've got what we need on this one. Subject to proposed changes in wording, are there any objections to the agenda decision? Well, you guys are on a roll on taxes. You need to bring us more.